Let's talk it over with Derek Gould as we talk about the upcoming Hall of Fame ballot, which has been mailed out to the voters of the Baseball Writers Association of America, of which Derek was the president at one point and a proud member of, and the beat writer for the St. Louis Cardinals on STL Today and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. As always, Derek, great to catch up with you. How are things going?
All right, Dan, good to hear from you. Congratulations on your Emmy Award. Well-deserved. Good to hear.
I appreciate
that. For you.
Thank you
very
much.
Is that number 17? Is that right?
No. I'm very proud of it. And it's something that everybody, you know, in our industry strives for. And we work with great people. So I'll leave it at that. So let's talk about, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Let's talk about the Hall of Fame. This is something that should be, in my opinion, you know, sacred for writers and sacred for Major League Baseball and sacred for those that get the chance to go in. I think you would agree with all that. So I just want to start with this because I think sometimes there's some misconceptions out there on how it works. So who are the actual voters for the Baseball Hall of Fame?
The actual voters for the Baseball Hall of Fame are eligible members of the Baseball Writers Association of America. And what it takes to be eligible, it takes being a member in good standing. It takes 10 consecutive years of being in the organization to then qualify for a ballot consideration. And then you have to be active. You have to actively be around the game, either in coverage or in some other capacity.
Sure.
So you just have to, they don't want people who were, 10 years as a baseball writer, some of which was on the beat, some of it wasn't, and then having a vote 20 years later when they're not around the game. Or, there were some folks who cover the Olympics who moved on from baseball. And it was like, well, if you're not actively engaged in covering the game, then let's rethink your active participant in voting on the Hall of Fame. So, the basic ones are 10 consecutive years. That's a big thing for a baseball writer. People will probably see that on social media when writers get their 10 years and the first Hall of Fame ballot shows up. It's a pretty big deal.
So, how many writers are usually on that list to be able to write and eligible under that criteria?
That's a great question. I want to say that it's between 300 and 400. I don't know this year's number. I do know that it was just less than 400 last year.
So it's a big number. And then when you guys are putting in your checks on, and it's literally like you get the ballot and you put a check mark by, it's not a hanging chad, so let's not go there. And we've had enough.
No.
I don't want to, we've had enough talking about recounts here. So you put your check on the box, clearly legible. How many votes do you get for the amount of people that are on the ballot? So number one, how many are on the ballot? And then how many players do you get to vote for?
Okay, so real quick, last year there were 397 voters, just to let you know. There were 397. I looked that up because I actually have this year's ballot right here in my hand. How many people are there on the ballot?
Correct, players.
There are 25 on this year's ballot.
Okay.
That number can change. This is something that is also important, is to be eligible for the Hall of Fame ballot, you have to not only be retired for several years, 5 years, but you also have to have played for 10. So it's like, so that's actually something when like people go, well, he's a Hall of Famer, or he's a future Hall of Famer, when a player's in year 7 of his career, it's like, well, not yet. No, he's not. You have to have 10 years. That's actually a rule for the Hall, a minimum of 10 years of playing in the majors. And then, that number, includes a bunch of different people who can have long careers in the majors. And then they're vetted to then get onto the ballot. So the 25, you can vote for at most 10. You can vote for fewer than 10, but you can vote for no more than 10. And to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, be elected into the Hall of Fame, you must have received 75% of the vote. So last year, that was 298 votes.
And last year, we saw Larry Walker get in. He made an incredible mm-hmm. jump. When you look at Larry Walker and his trajectory over the time that he was on the ballot, if you had to say he got in because of this and he started making a steady climb as it went through the mm-hmm. years, what would you point it to? Is it sabermetrics? Was it a harder look at the analytics of the game? His all-around performance? Were there lesser players on the ballot? Was it the fact he wasn't a steroid guy? How do you look at his trajectory as allowing him to get into the Hall of Fame? Which, by the way, I do think he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I've always thought he was a Hall of Famer. I have always voted for him too. I think there are two things. One is that there was a gradual ease of the ballot, meaning that a lot of times you could have looked at the ballot over the last few years and gone, there are 13, 14, 15 deserving people, but I can only vote for 10. And so you saw, some guys not get the support because when the Hall asks you to vote for 10 and only 10 at most, they're not asking you who are the Hall of Famers on the ballot. They're asking you who are the worthiest Hall of Famers on the ballot. And that's a terrible question, but that's what you're left with. And so people would rank however they would rank or come to a decision how they would do that as to how they would get their list of 12 or 13 or 15, deserving candidates down to 10. I think because there was a gradual ease of the candidates and thus you had more room on your 10, Larry Walker got more voters. I also think a huge part of it is that my generation of writers started voting.
Yeah.
I think that, that people my age and slightly younger started getting ballots. We were 10 years into our careers, 10, 11, 12. We were getting those ballots, and how we viewed Larry Walker, also how we approached the Coors Field question was less of a factor for us than just a great player.
Derek, I'm always curious when people say, well, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, but he wasn't unanimous. And we all know that the player is definitely a Hall of Famer. It's a slam dunk, right? He's going to go in, and yet he doesn't receive a vote or two from one of the voters. Why is that? Is that because they're saving the vote for somebody else, knowing that the other voters are going to vote them in? And they're saying, I'd rather give it to player X because he's on the fringe and I want to keep him on the ballot, or I want to get him in. Can you explain that to our listeners?
I cannot, because, I can tell you some of the reasons why. But I can also tell you why I think it's a little bit misleading. Derek Jeter fell one vote short. I don't really know of a good reason why you'd leave Derek Jeter off. You bring up the point that some people game the ballot, which is true. I've done that where I have one more spot left and it's either going to go to, I didn't want to vote for one guy without voting for three guys. So if I only had one spot left, then how do I use that spot to the best advantage? And in the past, at one point in time, I used that spot for Jim Edmonds because I felt that he deserved more of a conversation. I decided early on, though, that I was not going to game the ballot and not vote for Jeter or not vote for Ken Griffey, because I wanted to be part of the chorus of acclamation. I wanted to be part of that, groundswell that said this is a great player. I do not get hung up on. I'll ask it. Can I ask you a question, Dan?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So what is the difference between Ted Simmons Hall of Famer and Derek Jeter Hall of Famer?
They're both Hall of Famers. Once they're in, they're in.
They both have a plaque. No one asks how they got there.
That's right.
No one asks. They're not putting on their, when they sign a card, it's not, Jeter doesn't get to go HOF 99.7.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Simmons doesn't have to go HOF Veterans Committee.
Right.
It's HOF.
That's right.
HOF, it's immortality forever, and no one asks how you got there. And, for some players, it's a long time. For some players, it's, there are players who are posthumous who didn't get in until after their death. But for all players who are in there, they are Hall of Famers. And that title Hall of Famer bestows an immortality that doesn't ask what your vote count was. You're just there. And I try to keep that in mind. I know that having gone to the Cooperstown a few times, having talked to Hall of Famers, you know, they see, you know, a few of them see a distinction with the first ballot. But I get that sense that it's less and less, just in talking with some of the current round of players. Part of that is because of the voting trends. I think, you know, the fact that the players who are in right now all played against Bonds, all played against Clemens, all played against some of these other guys who they probably view as Hall of Famers and aren't yet in there, that it's changed that conversation a little bit as to, you know, yeah, Jeter set records for the, you know, are almost set records, I guess, almost tied a record, I guess I should say, for, you know, receiving votes. But the fact that he fell one short doesn't change his career, doesn't change Hall of Fame. It doesn't come with one fewer vowel or an asterisk. He is the Hall of Famer, and that's forever. So what people do with their ballots, you're right. I mean, there are people who think, well, he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, and thus I will never vote for him on the first ballot. I see less and less of that in voting trends. There are people who game the ballot, like you described. And then there are people who are just a little bit, you know, less, I don't know. They have less of a motive, or less of a clear cut motive, and why they do it, they keep to themselves.
So you lead me into the next kind of sticky subject here, which is the steroid guys, and Derek Gould of the Post-Dispatch is my guest. And where do you stand on this? And it's brought up every year. How do you look at the steroid guys and trying to keep them in, out, the morality clause, all those things, which is part of this
sportsmanship clause,
right? Sportsmanship, I should say. You know, so where do you stand on some of these guys and whether or not they should be in the Hall of Fame?
Let's see if I can find the sportsmanship clause here. Boy, oh boy. I was just looking here real quick. This makes for great radio. when it became possible that I was going to get a ballot, I knew I had to think about this. And my stance has been, that if I have fewer than 10 who I think are deserving for their careers, then I will vote for all of the players that I think are deserving. If I have more than 10 that I feel are deserving with their careers, then I have to use the tools at my disposal to whittle that list down to 10. One of the tools at my disposal, given to me by the Hall of Fame, is that sportsmanship clause. I only need to use it. You know, you don't need to use a hammer if there's not a, you know, nail coming out, right? You don't need to use a screwdriver unless the screw is loosened. But I need to use that tool when I have an excess amount of names to put on a 10-person ballot. And so that's when I do. I make the choice to use that tool. My approach has always been that if I can't write an article about it, then I can't vote. The ballot goes with my name on it, just like an article, just like a byline. And so if I can't attribute, if I didn't feel comfortable writing something in the newspaper, then I shouldn't feel comfortable professing it on my ballot. This past year was the first time that I voted for Clemens and Bonds. That's because I had spots on my ballot. I had, you know, two. I had three spots on my ballot. And so I voted for them because, and I had not in the past. I had lopped them off. They, you know, I'd given them consideration, but I had more than 12 deserving candidates. So I had to make a call, or I had one spot and I didn't want to put one of them over the other. You know, neither of them has admitted use. Gary Sheffield has discussed his use, right?
Yeah.
And so he's in a little bit different category, a tremendous player, a Hall of Fame caliber player, who, I think, deserves consideration. He has talked about his use, accidental, but has been in more detail than the other two. But there is a preponderance of evidence that you cannot ignore, and you could write an article about it. People have written articles. Books have been written about those two, and you know, I have to respect my colleagues in that way. So those are the standards that I use.
I'm also curious then, when you have a guy like Kurt Schilling, who's mm-hmm. on the ballot, and this is non-steroid issues, right. You know, we're talking about a guy that is, whether or not you believe in his political beliefs is kind of divisive, not kind of, mm-hmm. he's divisive in that regard. So mm-hmm. whether you believe in it or not, how do you as a voter or your colleagues, how do you separate what he's done post-playing career with his political stuff, and then just look hard at what he did as a player? And he's at, I think, 70% of the vote mm-hmm. going in.
Correct.
Which, and his trajectory would then, like most guys, they say, well, if you're at 70, you're probably you're going to get
yep.
in. You're going to get the votes.
Yep.
So it's really, you know, that's an interesting case study, too, I think, with Kurt Schilling.
Yeah. So Kurt Schilling is a difficult personality to deal with. But for me, not a difficult vote to deal with. So when I set forth to look at the ballot, I found that it was really difficult to distinguish between Kurt Schilling, Mike Mussina, and John Smoltz. I carved up their numbers a bunch of different ways. I looked at them through different lenses. I talked to different people, and more I found it hard to differentiate how one of those three was a Hall of Famer and not all of those three, or two of those three were Hall of Famers and not all three. And I continue to look back at that research and go over those numbers, and I continue to arrive at the same thing. John Smoltz is on TV and people know him well. That's his post-career. Mike Mussina, probably a little quieter, but everybody knows, and most people who know Mike Mussina are very fond of Mike Mussina. For his character and, you know, for how he went about it. Kurt Schilling has made noise off the field, most notably where he appeared to share and promote violence against journalists, which is revolting and despicable and dishonest and, you know, just awful. I find it vulgar and unprofessional, and all the words that I use to describe him, he won't get to call me those because I voted for him. And I am going to do with my ballot what he thinks reporters don't, and I'll prove him wrong that way.
And I think he's going to get in. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think he probably does get in, you know, and his speech will be memorable. And I look forward to him having to thank the same journalist that he threatened.
I think from a local perspective, a lot of people look at Yadier Molina. And I was thinking about this, and I'm very curious, as it pertains to if he went to New York, the amount of media attention and the writers, so many writers are in New York, if that mm-hmm. would make some of those guys that, if they are on the fringe, and gals, if they are on the fringe of looking at him as a Hall of Fame caliber type player, they get a couple of years of looking at him hard, looking at the not only the player for the 2 years, but then looking at the full body of work, the resume of his work, if that would enhance or put the final nail in the coffin. To me, the 2000th hit was it. He's in. But I wonder, Derek, just looking at it from a different perspective, if that would help his cause for the Hall of Fame.
I don't necessarily think so, to be honest. I do understand what you're saying in regards to the number of voters there. So it's sort of a common misconception that there is sort of this East Coast bias when it comes to some of the awards, the MVP, the Cy Young and everything like that. Well, they don't have any more votes in those cities than we have in St. Louis. You know, New York, you know, is a chapter and has two votes for the National League MVP. St. Louis is a chapter, has two votes for the National League MVP. So, you know, those are definitely more, you know, done by state. They're somewhat, to borrow a current phrase, somewhat like the Electoral College, right?
Gotcha.
It's by state.
Right.
The Hall of Fame is different because you're right. It's scattered, and it's not. It can be more of a popular vote type of thing. And if there are more long-serving baseball writers on the East Coast, and there are, because they're population centers, then you'd see a tilt. However, I will caution people, there are a lot of voters in St. Louis. There are a lot. St. Louis's number of voters far outpaces its per capita, as you'd expect. Part of that is because of the Sporting News. So many members of the Sporting News, because the Sporting News was written into the BBWAA constitution as members, are longstanding members of the BBWA who remain active around the game or in some way, can petition the Hall of Fame to stay active as a voter. And so St. Louis has quite a few, voters. The newspaper obviously has Rick and myself. Bernie Miklas is a voter. There are others here who have ties to the Post-Dispatch who are voters still in St. Louis. But the Sporting News really bulks it up. I will also add to that Yadier Molina's done okay in Queens and has made an impression.
Good point. That's a good point.
He is not, Yadier Molina has a reputation with the Yankee beat writers and the Yankee culture too, because, he's got the ties. Obviously, he's from Puerto Rico, and there are a lot of Molina fans that there's a Venn diagram there of people who pay attention and know what Yadier Molina has done. I think that being a Cardinal is a booster for him, because the Cardinals are part of that baseball royalty, the crown jewel organization.
Sure.
That helps him. That it would be different if Yadier Molina, we'll just borrow a recent example. It would be different if Yadier Molina were having the career that he's having, even with the championships with the Colorado Rockies.
Right.
And then you'd be like, oh, well, go to New York. That might boost his signal a little bit for the Hall of Fame. It might because, they'd get more attention. He would do it in a different ballpark. He'd be on TV more. How many times have the Cardinals been on Sunday Night Baseball in his career?
Right.
How many times have the Rockies been on Sunday Night Baseball in Nolan Arenado's career? Is it one?
Right, right.
That's, I mean, good point. Is that right?
Yeah.
Isn't it one?
I think so.
And it's probably, 45 or more?
Right.
For Molina. So,
and the postseason appearances and the national TV exposure there. Yeah, that's a good point.
And the World Baseball Classic.
Yep.
I don't think Yadier Molina's Q rating is lacking, and I don't think that going to New York will alter his Hall of Fame candidacy, except for the fact that it would mean some of the papers up there would constantly refer to him as a Hall of Famer or future Hall of Famer, and then eventually it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And then my final question, I watched this guy play in the prime of his career. I do believe he's a Hall of Famer.
Scott Rowland?
You got it. And he's at roughly, I think, 23-25%, like in that area, but he's
35.
That's right. He jumped from there. And so he's kind of going on the Larry Walker trajectory here. And I do think younger voters are looking at sabermetrics, and I can't imagine what this guy would be like in the shift now if teams shifted. I mean, it'd be a 6'4", 6'5" shortstop with the range of some of the best shortstops in the game. So,
yeah.
And his numbers are really good offensively. I think he's a Hall of Famer. So I'm curious what you think about his trajectory in trying to get to the Hall of Fame.
I think he is like the guy he sat next to many, many years ago when Larry Walker was the MVP and Scott Rowland was the Rookie of the Year. I think Scott Rowland will be a Hall of Famer. Just looking at these numbers, I think it's going to take some time like it did for Larry Walker.
Right.
The ballot is going to ease quite a bit this year. I mean, significantly. And then, this is the ninth year for Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Curt Schilling, and Sammy Sosa. So they get 10 years on the ballot, 10. And then after that, it thins really quickly. Whereas Scott Rowland is in his fourth year. He is not the highest vote getter of his class. The guys who are on their fourth year are Andrew Jones, Scott Rowland, and Omar Vizquel. Of that group, Vizquel has 50%. I have not voted for Vizquel, so I guess I'll have to take a look as to what I'm missing that other voters are seeing. But I have voted for Andrew Jones, and I have voted for Scott Rowland, and I will continue to vote for them. You know, I guess I was one of 77 people to vote for Andrew Jones this past year. But I think it's just going to take time. But I think it's going to happen. I think he's going to see a steep increase within the next 3 years that either could bring him in or put him right on the verge.
Hey, Derek, this was fun. Thanks for doing this, and have a great Thanksgiving. Stay safe and healthy with you and your family, and I really appreciate you doing this, and we'll catch up soon.
Looking forward to it, Dan. Thanks. Hopefully that was a good conversation for folks to understand, and if they have other questions, I'm not really hard to find. I'm happy to talk about it.
You got it. That's Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.